What's up, my little weed heads? How you guys doing? Zach here before the podcast rolls up. Just to let you know, if you do want to buy the Schmucks Vsauce print, you can do that at sharkrobot.com/psychicpebbles. It's going to be up for only 1 week. Buy it for yourself. Buy it for your girlfriend. Buy it for your mother. What I recommend is buy it, rolling it by stuffing weed inside of the print and just smoking a gigantic fucking blunt. And I'm serious about that.
Since the dawn of mankind, humans have gazed at the stars and asked themselves questions as the stars gazed back. Why are we here? Are we alone? How will it all end? However, out of all the questions man has asked over the millennia, there remains one that trumps all others. What if a nasally online web animator started a podcast where he shot the shit with a guest for an hour or two while you sat there with your gut hanging out? While most of man's questions remain unanswered, I do have an answer for that last one, right now.
On Schmucks.
It's a very irrational fear that I'm going to get a stroke, but I feel like I'm the kind of guy who would get a stroke. It's based off nothing, just other than my own gut feeling.
Yeah, no, I have that same gut feeling, and I'll be totally serious. Whenever I smell something weird, like all of a sudden, I actually get panicked that I'm having a stroke.
You think you're stroking out when you smell like a flower?
Yeah, like I smelled a burning light the other day when I was on a set, and it just, it wasn't like it gradually appeared, it was just all of a sudden a lot of a new smell, and I was like, this is it, I'm done. And I really thought my heart rate actually increased.
I have that same like, oh god, this is it, it's all collapsing in front of me, this is where I fall and die. I have that exact same horrible neurotic fear. I'm also really irrationally afraid of schizophrenia, I don't know why.
Well, yeah, there's something really terrifying about being separated from reality. And there's something conversely very comforting about knowing that the way you work cognitively is the way almost everyone else does. So you're not weird, you're not dangerous, you're just fitting in, and then you can be creative within that groove. But once you start to not know what groove you're in, that's when you get panicky. I feel the same way when I'm driving. Sometimes, especially if there's like no traffic on the freeway, I start realizing, oh my gosh, I'm going way faster than I feel comfortable going. I'm still under the speed limit almost all the time, but man, I'm like, what's stopping me from just turning this wheel, spinning it really quickly, toppling the car over? I literally could do that. I think I'm feeling that same thing that I feel when I'm in a high place. And I feel almost drawn to the edge, as if some part of me wants to jump. I've researched this feeling, and one theory that I like, that I think sounds reasonable, is that you are so scared of falling, but you don't normally fall, you don't normally spastically move, that your brain has to figure out what's going on. Why are you so scared of something happening that's so unlikely? And it concocts an excuse, which is that you must want to, or there must be some force that might cause you to do that. It might cause you to jump from the cliff. It might cause you to just jerk the wheel. And that's never going to happen, but yet the fear exists. And so there's this third thing that emerges from both of them, which is I'm out of control.
That's interesting, because you only have those thoughts when you're really out of the element that our bodies and minds kind of evolved into. Like, we didn't evolve to drive a 1,000-pound metal thing at 70 miles an hour. It just doesn't happen. So maybe that could... So you're saying that's our mind's way of kind of, like, I guess, compensating for that, basically? That feeling of, I could just slam to the guy next to me and watch his car roll off and his car explodes.
Well,
also, high places.
I would never do that to someone else. For some reason, I feel comfortable... It's just my own self I'm nervous about wrecking. But yeah, you're exactly right. I don't see why natural selection would ever remove irrational fears like that, because in the long run, they do protect you. Someone who's irrationally afraid of high places is definitely going to go up to them way less frequently and fall way less frequently. Now, the only reason it would get selected out would be if high places provided some kind of advantage. But for the most part, we're, you know, eating things that are down here on the ground. We're not mountain goats. We're not birds. How sad would it be to be a bird that was afraid of heights?
You ever think about what it'd be like to be one of these animals? Just to kind of live in their minds for like 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Just kind of feel through their consciousness?
Yes, it's very difficult to do. It is actually a famously difficult philosophical problem. What is it like to be a bat? What is it like to be a cat? What is it like to be a single-celled organism? We can only imagine our own human consciousness, but with a different body. We can't ever imagine a different way of looking at the world. The same could even possibly be said for people from the historical past. What was it really like? What was it like to think, to daydream in the year 12?
Right.
I mean, your experiences and the structure of what's unknown then versus now is just so different. Can I even put myself in their shoes?
Oh, well, I'm sure that question gets even stickier when you, like, the closer you get to humans. Like, I'm sure it'd be, anybody would know, you know it's, you'd be radically different to be like a rat or a mouse or something, or a cockroach. But if you're talking about like a Neanderthal or humans like 40,000 years ago that are just kind of on the edge, that'd be weirder to me, honestly, because if you're a bat or a mouse or something, it's obviously radically different. But what if you're, like, right on the edge of modern human, like, on Neanderthal specifically, what would that be like?
Yeah, like say, 10,000 years before agriculture was invented.
Right.
Right? Like, you're still biologically a human. You are a Homo sapiens sapien. There's really no reason to believe that you don't have the same mental experiences that we have today, except you have no idea that there's this thing called agriculture coming, or this thing called writing coming. And are we in a similar position? Like, are we in 50,000 years, will there be a descendant of us thinking, or something related to us? I guess it couldn't really be a descendant. We'd have to talk millions and millions of years in that case. But look, will people 50,000 years from now think, what would it have been like to have been a person in 2017? You would have missed so much. You would have no idea where your species was headed. It's just, I can't even imagine being Michael and Zach back then.
Yeah. What is your theory on consciousness? I know you did a video. That's a big question. You don't have to go all the way into it, but I know you did a video on it, but that is something I think about a lot, just because I can't. I mean, do you think it's gradual? Or do you think it's like a switch? What is your belief on that, based on what you've looked into?
So, my belief? I don't actually know. Whenever someone asks, I tend to say that I believe it's a switch. Mainly because I don't think that within my lifetime I will ever be proven right or wrong. So, I just err on the side of, I think there's something about it that we're not going to... We'll either never replicate, say, in a machine, or we'll never know if we've replicated or not in a machine. I don't know why I give that answer. I think that I feel like it's a bit safer, because it kind of leads to, like, well, if it's going to be hard to know if a machine has consciousness and awareness of itself, then maybe we should even treat animals and plants and cockroaches like they might have plans for the future. It just seems kinder.
Right.
In the face of not knowing, I guess I'll just pick the one that'll make me the nicest to an animal. But I don't have any real basis besides that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, you look at a cat or something, and you can, or a dog even, or a chimpanzee or bonobo or something. You can almost sort of see how, because I mean, consciousness. I mean, how would you define it specifically? Just kind of self-awareness, sentience, the ability to plan, the ability to reason?
Yes. The only difference, though, is that animals clearly reason. I've seen a cat use what appears to be reason and logic, but I've never seen a cat weep or laugh. Are those more unique to humans? I don't know.
I made a cat laugh one time.
How'd you do it?
I undressed in front of it to go in the shower, and it laughed at me.
Have you reported these results to science?
Yeah, they just laughed at me also, and I felt worse, and I left.
I think you're onto something there.
Stephen Hawking, if you're listening, drop what you're doing, come to me, I got some ideas for you, buddy.
Do you think Stephen Hawking listens to this podcast?
I think he throws it on whenever he's punching numbers around.
Yeah, he's got it on to kind of free his mind, think creatively, think outside
yeah,
the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a break.
He's gonna hear this, and he's gonna. It's all gonna click for him. He's gonna figure out the one-inch equation to figure it all out from this podcast.
You're welcome.
He's got me to think. You're welcome, buddy. Hey, just put my name at the bottom of the book. I don't care. Little print, fine print. I don't care. That's fine. It works for me. Just say I co-wrote it. That's fine. That's all I need. Yeah. I mean, the consciousness he always is. Something he says it's gradual, that it's like a slow kind of like a layered process almost. Because, like, again, like, bonobos, for example, they have that thing, the other mind theory or whatever, where basically they know they're conscious, or they at least know what they are, they at least know that they can recognize themselves in mirrors, but they don't know that other things are conscious. I forget what the exact thing is called.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about the mirror test, where, you know, you put a dot on their head while they're under an anesthetic, and then the question is, will they look in a mirror and realize that it's them? Or will they act towards other animals, like those animals have information about the world that they don't? Do they have a concept of other minds?
Right, it was the other mind idea, which fascinated me. They did a test where they had two pairs of glasses. One was painted black on so you couldn't see through them. The other one was transparent, and they put both on the monkey, so the monkey knew which one it couldn't see through. And then they put those two different glasses on different people, and the monkey still approached the guy with the glasses that weren't, you know, were opaque. He still, like, asked the guy for something. He still thought the guy could see him.
Right, yeah, I actually talked about a similar study in one of my TED Talks, but rather than having glasses that were blacked out, it was a bucket that went over your head. And apes or whatever it was, orangutans, they still acted like, you have a bucket on your head. Let me remember, how did this go? Yeah, I think they didn't realize who they should speak to get information that they didn't
I think in the one I saw, it was a little documentary, I think it was food specifically, they had food in their hand, and right. They were kind of tapping the guy in the leg saying, hey, give me the food. Or they were waving, I think it was, but they were behind glass, something to that effect, where they had to, see if the guy would give them the food, but they didn't realize that they couldn't even see them. So as far as we know, we're the only creatures on Earth that can do that.
Well,
have been able to.
Yes, but I still don't know how those experiments are going to answer the philosophical question, because an animal could learn that if a person has a bucket on their head, they didn't see what happened, but that doesn't mean that they are aware of themselves. It just means that the same way a ball rolls down a hill but isn't aware that it's doing that, it just does it because that is a natural phenomenon, because of gravity, right? Like, how do we know that these aren't just the dominoes of some automatic process falling? But where's that strange loop that occurs where you're not only doing the thing, but you're aware that you're doing it, and you can't prove to other people that you're aware that you're doing it? As far as you know, everyone that isn't you is a zombie. They could literally just be robots that behave and react to things as if they're aware of themselves, but you can't climb into their heads and be them.
Do you think consciousness is a biological, or sorry, evolutionary given? Like, it's a natural, I mean, given's kind of like a misdirect, I guess I should say. Do you think it's likely, or do you think it was sort of specifically an evolutionary advantage to be conscious?
I think it had an evolutionary advantage simply because simply because it exists. That's a kind of lamer answer. It's just like, well, of course, it's the way things are, and so therefore it must have been to an advantage. I think it impacts too much of our lives to just be some ancillary byproduct or arbitrary thing that occurred. I really do think that our self-awareness allows our DNA to replicate itself more, meaning our species can survive better than, say, cows, if we assume that cows are not aware of their own selves, that we can think, we have a better sense of time as well in the future, and what the future of our planet is, the future of our species, what benefits, you know, technology and research today will have in for a time that we won't be alive for as individuals. So, I mean, if you look at everything as just a trait that allows DNA molecules to keep replicating, then I could see why consciousness would be to their advantage.
I mean, you could argue, yeah, I guess my question kind of answered itself. It's like, if consciousness wasn't an evolutionary advantage, we wouldn't be asking if it was an evolutionary advantage or not. You know what I mean? Like, of course it is, because it's here. We're asking the question if it is or not.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like a lot of things that emerge from evolution, it has downsides as well. I mean, could you make the argument that there's a burden consciousness brings, that there's like an existential fear that maybe a lot of other animals don't have, that can lead to things and behaviors that are counter to reproduction? Certainly. But in the long run, I would assume that it's been advantageous, because we're here and we appear to be thriving. Now, we also, of course, are developing things and doing things that could literally put our entire species in jeopardy. But, you know, alone amongst Earthlings, we are the ones who can also stop those things.
How do you feel about that, actually? I'm curious. What is your personal belief? I mean, kind of throw everything else out the window for a second. What is your personal belief? Do you think we're going to wipe ourselves out?
Well, it's a really good question. And of course, I don't have any reason to believe any particular answer. So I'm trying to figure out which answer I want to believe.
Want to believe, but also just gut feeling, just looking around the world, wanting to believe, and just kind of based off the information you have, but also very kind of gut feeling, you know, not very scientific at all.
I think that we will exist for a very, very long time, but that depends on how you define we. Does it count if we wipe out our own species, but some, you know, DNA from some organic tissue is launched into space and billions of years later lands on another planet, and all of a sudden it starts being able to reproduce itself? Maybe it's not so much from us, but it's from a virus. Does that still count as Earth life continuing? I think there's a lot of promise in some of the things we're looking at in terms of diversifying our habitat. Like, why don't we start looking at other planets? Why don't we start looking at building places in orbit around our sun or other suns that could be good homes if Earth were to become uninhabitable? That's all far future stuff, though. But, you know, on the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that we won't live for that much longer. The biggest one is the fact that we haven't met any other civilizations outside of Earth. We haven't met any. So is there some limiting factor out there where a species reaches a certain point in its intelligence and technology at which it just cannot function any longer, and it destroys itself or its planet, either as an accident or perhaps voluntarily? It would certainly seem that there's a lot of evidence for that, because we haven't seen any other aliens.
It's called the Fermi paradox, right? The kind of notion of the basic premise is, if they're out there, where are they? Why can't we hear them?
Life is a thing that happens in our universe, and our universe is just so gosh darn old and large, like, where's the rest of it? And yeah, the possible explanations are just the most beautiful things to read. It's like so many sci-fi ideas. I mean, one is that, oh no, they're there, but they don't want to interfere. We're kind of like a zoo to them. Another is that other intelligent life out there that did not originate on Earth is just so advanced that they literally don't pay us any mind. We are like the germs on the surface of an orange. We just eat an orange and we don't pay any attention to the life that's already on its surface. We don't even think about it. It's not interesting to most of us, and we just throw it in the garbage. That could be the case. It could also be the case that there are none, you know, and there never have been. It could also be the case that they keep popping up and they only last long enough to, say, discover the power of the atom.
That what interests me the most is the possibility that, oh yeah, they're popping up everywhere, but I mean, the universe is 13 billion years old. You could pop up and last for a million years and still never meet another civilization or never bump into them. Even if we last for 100,000 years, we're still going to be out, likely. That's before we meet anybody else.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing to think about those distances and how big the universe is, how long it takes even to get to the nearest star systems. It's something that, just compared to the length of a human life, makes it very difficult to imagine life ever being more than what we experience now. One planet, one species of humans, intelligent life like us. But at the same time, that also makes it really fun to hang on to dreams of faster-than-light travel, finding ways to move through other dimensions to cross our three space faster, building drives that compress or expand space behind and in front that allow us to not break the speed of light, but still traverse distances in space faster than a light would otherwise. If we can't develop technology like that, we're much more stuck where we are.
Hey, what's up, my jiggers? This is Little Mikey here from Little Mikey's Jigs. Sorry about that jiggers part, by the way. That was a bit of a mistake. But I don't know how to use the audio editing software, so I think that's stuck there now. But look, let's just move on. Little Mikey's Jigs, what I'm all about. I come to your house and I do a little bit of a jig. What do you think about that? That's right, I do a bit of a dance right in your living room. Your kids are going to go absolutely fucking wild when they watch me. My arms, my legs, they're going to be flailing. And basically, I think in this current climate with North Korea and ISIS, I think we just need a little bit of joy and entertainment in the world. So that's what I'm all about. But look, they're telling me I've got to wrap it up, but Little Mikey's Jigs is what the company is. Get me to come around, and I'm going to just do a little dance for you. It's going to be fun, and let's try to make the world a better place, guys. Thanks, everyone.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
What terrifies the hell out of you? What scares you more than anything? I don't mean like a whale or something. I mean like, in the world of science, in the world of what you do, what prospect, what concept horrifies you?
Just a lot of softball questions in this podcast today.
What's your favorite color?
My favorite color is yellow, but what terrifies me is...
Yeah, what keeps you up at night? What makes you wake up screaming at the demons that surround you, trying to pull your soul out, Michael?
Nothing causes me to wake up in the middle of the night. I will say that lately, I've been doing a lot of reading, like a lot. I mean, and this actually gets in the way of writing episodes and producing them, but I think there has to be a trade-off. Like, I have to consume ideas before I can have my own. And right now, I'm in this phase of reading a lot about space and time and dimensions. I'm trying to visualize a fourth spatial dimension, and there are moments in the car or at night going to bed where I start to get this feeling that I'm really close and that it's just going to pop into my mind and I'm going to see myself, or I'm going to see a cube or a sphere from the perspective of someone that's a four-dimensional creature, and I don't know if I'm ready for that, and I actually hesitate and change my train of thought because it might bewilder me, it might scare me, it might make me realize how small I am, that there's an infinite number of other 3D spaces all parallel to this one. And that's a weird thing to be terrified of, but I was surprised by that anxiety that I started to get.
I mean, there's a possibility. I mean, you know, this is a lot more it's a lot less to do with reading and educating yourself, but a lot of people, when they do certain psychedelics, their worldview snaps. I mean, that could be that's a possibility. If you really visualize something from a different perspective, that could really snap you into a different place, and you might even get back. That's a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's terrifying, not being able to get back, because I like what I am right now. And in a way, you can become afraid that a different way of thinking or a different kind of knowledge might fundamentally divorce you from everyone that you love and know. That's unlikely, but there's a fear for you. I'm not afraid of death. I'm afraid of pain. I don't want to get hurt. But I remember being asked at Bucharest Comic Con by someone in the audience, you know, if you could live forever, would you? And I said, no, I think it's important to die. And the crowd erupted in applause. I don't know if it's something about Romania or something about the kind of people that like...
those guys, they love death, all right? Those Romanians, they love it. They can't get enough of it.
But again, I don't know if I really have a justification for that opinion, or if it's just it makes me feel better to not be afraid to say, this is important. I understand the value in it. I understand that that's how life progresses, and I don't know. I like thinking that I've got this finite little slice of time, and I get to do something in, and people will remember it. It can get scary to think that, yeah, but what if all humans go extinct, say in the year 3000? Then there won't be anyone left to remember what you did, or to enjoy the trees you planted, or swim in the ripples that you left behind. Well, then what's the point? Actually, I had a friend who was really aggressive about recycling. It would always give me a hard time if I, didn't use something recyclable. And then something happened years later, and I joked about how, oh, hey, I've got this, I forgot to recycle the can. Are you mad? And he was like, what does it matter? Like, our sun's going to burn out eventually. Like, we may as well.
God.
And I was like, whoa.
Jesus.
He thought in the short term it's good to do these things, but in the long run, like, we're going to eventually reach a heat death where energy is completely spread out and no work can be done any longer in the universe. So what's the point? And I was like, dude, you're talking about like a thing that's a Google years in the future. Like, this is maybe not something to worry about. But I'm also reminded of my favorite quote from a book, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And the quote is, it's just another one of those kind of comforting thoughts that I haven't seriously investigated. But the quote was something like, the magnitude of a person's life isn't measured by their external displacement, but by their subjective experiences. Your impact isn't what measures your worth, but it's your own experiences internally.
Are you big on, like, impact? I feel like that... Do you ever go kind of like, would you want to watch your funeral, Tom Sawyer style, just kind of just observe it?
Oh, man. If there's anything I could wish for, it would be to see my own funeral. And also to hang out and, like, see what people say about me, years and decades after I've passed away. But I think that's actually not a good thing to wish for, because what you'll realize is how infrequently people talk about you. Life goes on. And, yeah. It's the same old world. So yeah, but being concerned about impact and ambition and legacy, those are, what are those but grasps at immortality? Yes, maybe I won't be alive any longer, but a book I write will be, or my videos will still be on YouTube, or my kids will still, have lessons they learned from me that they'll pass on in some way to their kids. And so really, like, I'm still around. And so, but I think if you get too wrapped up in that, in external displacement and impact, you start to, it's a losing game, And the only thing you can really be certain of is, I'm really enjoying the way it feels to be with these people right now. And that's, if that's all it takes, then check that off the box. I'm good.
No, my hope would be that I have some sort of legacy, not because I want a legacy, but because it means I hopefully did something good. Like, that, I want that not as a goal, but as a byproduct of a good goal, if that makes sense. Like, you pretty much get a legacy two ways. One way you do something good, the other way is you do something bad. You're either Hitler or, like, George Washington. That's a weird analogy. The point is, though...
yeah, you get to be one or the other. Pick.
There's no other option. You have to pick it at birth. My point is, he didn't do what he did because he wanted to be known. He did it because he was an asshole, but he was known for being an asshole. Does it make sense? So, if you're remembered for a little bit afterwards, it means you did something that at least people were like, oh, that was new.
Yeah, and of course, we're talking about being remembered by, like... lots of people who never even personally met you. That's a certain kind of remembrance and fame. But I wonder what fraction of humans will even attain that kind of legacy. Yeah. I think I may have tried to do this, like take the 100 billion or so humans who have ever existed and then figure out how many of them were quote unquote famous and for how long, and figure out what the chances are that any baby born is actually going to be remembered longer than, say, 100 or so years after its birth, after its death, rather.
Here's a good experiment. On the street, ask somebody, how many people can you name that have been dead since, like, before 1950?
Yeah.
You could probably name 100, really. I mean, it's really, that's out of 100 billion people, 80, 190 billion people who've ever lived?
Yeah.
That's 100, maybe.
Maybe.
And if you're lucky.
How far back can you even remember your own ancestors? For some people, that answer is quite long. However, they only have names or maybe a photograph back only a handful of generations. Some people can go really far back. This is a fantastic video idea. What's the equation that describes the decay rate of your memory after your death? Because I've been reading, like I said, a lot of books about the dimensions, and a lot of this gets into ideas about the shape of the universe and things like that. And when you read a book from like the early 1900s, they're mentioning scientists who are not mentioned any longer because their theories turned out to be not exactly in line with observations or are now debunked. But at the time, they were just really significant, really respected. And only a few continue past that point, either because they have stood the test of time in their correctness, or they were so wrong that they became famously wrong.
Are you saying the ether is that proven fact? I don't believe you.
You still believe in a universal ether that...
I refuse to drop the idea of an ether. I believe in it. I don't care what the evidence says.
Well, it is. It might seem like it's not worth reading what people said about ether and things that we no longer found any. We never found experimental evidence for. But to follow their lines of reasoning, you really become amazed by people and how smart they are, even when they're wrong. I think it's Charles Hinton who wrote. Let's see. I've got his book right here. Well, I've actually got a selection of. His works edited by Rudy Rucker, and he was explaining how the ether is actually we're actually a 3D universe that's on the surface of some 4D thing, and ripples in that surface is what describes the ether. And the thing is, it's a brilliant and elegant theory, but it just turned out to not be necessary, and it didn't describe things quite as well as relativity. And this is going beyond the purview of what I understand or can wrap my head around. It's been years and I still don't understand many of the things that people in the early 1900s were able to understand.
That is, yeah, it's interesting to go back and look at their line of reasoning, because that's a really eloquent theory. That's not stupid. That's a really elaborate concept you probably put a lot of man hours into, and it just happened to be wrong. I remember I read or I saw a video or something, the gist of it was they tried to do experiments to prove the ether, and they were proven wrong. And the guy was like, "Oh, the instruments must be messed up." Instead of just going, "Oh, well, I guess the ether's not real," instead he was like, "Okay," I think it was actually two people who tried the experiments. I'm sure somebody in the comments is going to correct me. But the basic, I think it's interesting. Instead of, because it was so accepted at that time, instead of just going, "Oh, I guess it's wrong," they thought the experimentation was broken. They thought the instruments were broken. They thought they were doing it wrong, and they did it a couple times. And it was the same result every single time.
Yeah, yeah. And I also don't know the history well enough, and that's what's bad about being on record saying things, because then people will correct you. But I believe I heard that, after the Michelson-Morley experiment, which probably isn't even the name of it. I'm probably getting that wrong too. The names.
Yeah,
of the,
whatever. They could cry about it. Whatever. We'll
take it as an invitation to go do your own research and learn. You're welcome. But anyway, yeah, they weren't finding that the speed of light was different if it was moving along with the Earth or perpendicular to the Earth's motion through space. And then people like Lorentz perhaps came along and said, "Well, you know what? Maybe your instruments are changing their size as they move through the ether in different directions." And Einstein was like, "Hey, maybe there's no ether and this just happens. And maybe space and time are the same thing. And time is really just it kind of emerges because of your relationship to the speed of light." And everyone was like, "Say what?" And saying what? And playing around in that space. And it's just fantastic. And I don't know if we're ever going to... reach some kind of unified theory of everything, a theory of everything. There's a great book I want to read. I don't even want to bring this up because I haven't read it. I have nothing to say about it, but it's called The End of Science, and it's a very controversial book that's now decades old, but it was kind of about that idea of, like, when is science going to reach a wall where experimentation and observation can no longer go any further, and everything else is just faith. Once we hit that point, what happens to society? I'm not sure once I read the book, I'm going to agree with everything in it, but I think it's important to wade around in those kinds of thoughts.
The whole concept of an equation for everything, the one-inch equation, like E equals MC squared, I find it kind of weird that we think the universe is obligated to fit like that. Maybe it will fit like that. Maybe we're missing crucial pieces. But maybe there is. Maybe it's going to be complex and messy and sticky.
I think it's a big mess, and all of the work we can do through science will tell us how, but it won't tell us why. Even if we came up with some brilliant theory of everything, you would still wonder why that theory? Why does our universe not act according to some other theory? And you can posit things like parallel universes or, theories that explain that every possible set of physical laws exists. And it's this universe that we just happen to be in. Actually, it's not just that we happen to be in it. Only this particular set of laws can lead to intelligent life like us. So, of course, we would find ourselves here. But there are other universes that only last for a second because they've got the wrong laws and constants. Or where is math, by the way? Like, where the heck is pi? Pi is an irrational number, the expression of which is unending. So how does a particle know to behave according to a constant that doesn't even, its digit expression doesn't end? And I think these questions will probably remain always unsolved. They could potentially become their own religion. The way that you believe math is either discovered or invented might become some new form of faith-based religion, because we'll realize that we're not getting anywhere through observation and experimentation.
I could absolutely see that happening. Yeah, the concept of laws to begin with, like you said, I mean, if this was a universe without those laws, and this is almost used by a lot of people as an argument for God, I don't mind it, but the argument goes, well, look how perfect Earth and humans are, look how perfect the solar system and the universe is. See, that's evidence. Well, it's like, well, if they weren't like that, then we couldn't ask the question, why is it perfect, essentially. That's the argument. And the same thing applies on a broader scale for the universe. Well, if we lived in a universe where we couldn't exist, we wouldn't be asking why we're existing, essentially.
Yeah, that's the famous anthropic principle. But one of my favorite explanations at the moment is also not something that we know how to experimentally investigate, but it's Lee Smolin's theory of universal natural selection. And I'm going to butcher the actual theory, but in essence, he says, well, what if at the singularity of a black hole, a new universe blooms, but its constants and laws are all a little bit, distorted from the universe that the black hole began in. But it's still related. It's basically a child of the universe that came before it. And what happens then is that universes in which black holes can form will naturally have more baby universes. There will be more universes like that. And it's a funny consequence of that universes that can easily create black holes are ones that can easily create suns. And suns are necessary for planet systems and life like us. So there you go. The universe naturally moved in a direction towards our existence simply because it needed black holes in order to reproduce. I would highly suggest reading Lee Smolin's work. He has a book that does not discuss this theory in too much detail called Time Reborn. It was actually illustrated by Henry from Minute Physics. It's a great, great book. He's written other books about natural selection in the universe. I'm not remembering the names of them at the moment, but you can look it up. I mean, they're not always easy reads, but that's good. I mean, you should be underlining things in books, and you should be Googling, every word you don't understand and getting other books. And whenever another author or book is mentioned in a book, get that book. And it's like real world Wikipedia, And you'll eventually, through osmosis, absorb a better understanding of the topic. I don't think you'll ever fully understand anything, and neither does anyone, but that's what I believe.
Well, look, if I find the titles after this for any of those books, I'll be sure to throw them up, like, right now.
And I always feel bad, though, recommending books, because I don't know what someone else's experience with that same book might be. And as I read more and more, I'm starting to read things that I don't really like that much, or I feel are like maybe totally out of date, and everyone would agree, but yet there was still some element to it that's good. And I'll be trying to follow their argument, and I'll be underlining things that I don't believe, that no one believes anymore, but I just am underlining because I want to follow their train of thought. And then I'm terrified that, like, someday my kids will see these books and go, "Why did he underline that? Did he think that was true?"
You should write false. You should write fake news under
everything.
Like,
should I write a question mark next to this or something to, like, indicate to future people that, look, I'm just underlining this because it's a key point in the book, but of course I don't think that it leads to you know, what it concludes. And actually no one does, but this book was written more than 100 years ago or something.
I like to do that with the kind of this, that same sort of mentality going into old books, but for history stuff. I picked up a book... It was, like, written 10 to 15 years after the Civil War, and it's a genuinely really old book. It's from that age, and I was flipping through it, and I was fascinated by looking at how they were writing about it. They were like, "Well, I guess we're going to figure out how the Civil War looks in 100 years." And I was that really fascinates me, looking back and seeing how people were viewing stuff at the time it was happening, or, like, right after it was happening.
Yes.
That fascinates me so much.
Contemporaneous sources are the most cool thing. And I learned that when I got a book when I was a kid, and it was like a collection of the New York Times movie reviews of, like, the top 1,000 movies. And of course, these were written at the time that the movie came out. So you read the review of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was my favorite movie when I was a kid and still is, and the review is not some glowing historical retrospective. It's like a contemporary reaction to what the movie means right then, and it doesn't go overly flowery about the impact of the movie, because it can't. And yeah, to read also, like, you'll hear about people in the past and you just do not understand their thought processes in retrospect. So you need to read their letters and read the newspaper coverage of events from the past written at that time. And you still can't put your head in their heads, but you get closer.
I like to just really focus and try to put my head in the mind of somebody in terms of, like, comedy, like, joking. Was it you who did a video about the oldest joke?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it was the Egyptian, the fart joke.
Yeah.
I think that might have been one of the first videos I saw of yours. I was looking into, I was Googling, what's the oldest joke in the world? Because that stuff fascinates me. And I think about that a lot when I think about people who lived, because when you think about the 1800s, you think about this kind of black and white,
yep,
people scowling, and no, people were joking every day. People, this is a really dumb thought, but I wonder if the funniest joke ever told has been just vanished for 1,000 years. Like, what was the funniest circumstance ever that we just missed out on because it was never recorded?
Yes.
Or the funniest joke ever told? There could have been a perfect joke, and it's just gone.
I would, interesting. Now, I was going to counter that how you define a good or perfect joke keeps changing. But that still doesn't mean that there wasn't, at some point, a joke that, in the context of its current time, was... so it was funnier than any joke that's happened in the last, 100 years. I could buy that, and by funny I mean caused people to laugh out loud. Let's just define our terms. But that also means that, I think I covered this in a video once. I tried to calculate out the likelihood that you have heard the funniest joke that caused you to laugh the most yet in your life, and it was very much based on like why it's best to keep living, because one, you probably haven't heard the funniest joke yet unless you're, like, under a certain age. I don't know how I possibly could have calculated this, but I also said even if you're super old, there are a bunch of people who still have not heard the funniest joke that they will ever hear, and they could hear it from you. So I'm glad you're all here.
That's, well, the same sort of mindset goes into, like, they say you're not going to have the best meal or see the best movie or see, or your favorite, I should say, not the best, but... because it's subjective, but they say that, you don't have your favorite meal until you're in your 40s or 50s. It's like, it's way on. The same thing goes for the joke thing. But I do wonder what, like, there had to be a point in, like, 10,000 BC when guys were, like, pissing themselves laughing at just a weird concoction of a situation.
Yeah, and no one's ever laughed like that No brain has ever had that reaction to a joke since. And if we heard the joke today, we wouldn't react that way because we're too different. And our right. world is too different, our society. I got a Kindle years ago, and there was a free joke book I could download from like 1880. And not only were the jokes not funny to me, they weren't even sensical to me. I actually remember one of them. The joke was, what is the same between a baseless quarrel and a radio conversation? They're both words over nothing.
See, if you would have told that joke 500 years ago, you'd be stoned to death for being a witch. They wouldn't even understand.
Yeah, and if you tell the joke today, you're not stoned to death. It's just people roll their eyes and say, oh my gosh, what the heck is he talking about? So the joke is only funny for this little slice of time in this little context.
And now, it's time for some questions.
All right, now for the crazy question time. The first one comes from Hobo Joe Pizza, who says, what is the scariest experience you've ever had in life? Thank you for answering.
When I was in college, I went to see a play with a friend of mine, and we stopped and got gas afterwards on our way to a friend's house to talk about the play. And we were pulled over by the cops. This was in Chicago, and they really treated us like they knew that we had a bunch of illegal drugs in the car, which we didn't, but they took us out of the car. They kept saying things like, wow, you guys smell like weed, and why are you so nervous? And they patted us down and said, you know, if you realize that if I find something on you, you're going to jail tonight. And they asked me like 5 times before they did the search. And I'm like, yeah, I understand. And then I wondered, like, why are you asking me this so often? Like, are you going to plant something on me? I got so scared. And then they're asking me, wow, you're really nervous. Like, what are you hiding? And I'm like, I'm just nervous because I have no idea what's going on. And then, of course, they found nothing and let us go. And it was just like, oh, my gosh, that was intense and frightening. And I had no idea what the outcome was going to be. I mean, I knew what it should have been. I hadn't done anything wrong. But that didn't really seem to matter.
Yeah, whenever I get, I know the exact feeling. That, by the way, that's horrifying. But when I get nervous around cops anyways, if I'm doing nothing, when I'm driving or walking and I see a cop, I freeze up even though I'm not doing anything wrong. I don't have drugs on me. I'm not speeding. My tags are all good. I still freeze up when I don't. It's probably because they're cops. And whenever I get stopped by cops or whenever I've been pulled over or whatever, I treat them with respect. I always say thank you and everything. But sometimes you just get those maniacs who get a rush from just having the power of being a cop.
I also think that fear is also related to all kinds of socially awkward fears. Like, oh my gosh, like I'm going to say something and how are they going to interpret it? But then when it comes to the law, it's like, oh my gosh, if I do something that's misinterpreted, the consequences could be really bad. Not just embarrassment, but like jail time. Like, what am I doing that I'm not realizing might look bad? I'm not doing anything bad intentionally, but what if like the way my hand moves is just wrong enough that I get shot? You know, and you're like terrified of this stuff. And I'm sure there's a lot of interesting psychology behind that.
Dude, I'm so neurotic. I was getting coffee. I was pulling a lighter like three nights ago. And I was getting a cup of coffee at this 24-hour coffee place. And I was just kind of standing there. And I heard like the pitter-patter of footsteps. And it was a jogger. But I turned around and for some reason I had my brain immediately went to, this guy's going to stab you in the throat.
Yeah.
He's coming. He's just gonna stab you. You're just gonna get stabbed to death, and you're gonna end up on some live leak video from the coffee shop's camera. And I instinctively held my hands up like I was protecting my organs, and the guy looked at me like I was a psycho, rightfully so, and he kept jogging. So if that's how I am with joggers at like 10 p.m.
Yeah,
I'm horrified to ever be in a situation where I'm a little bit out of my element with a cop, where I go to reach for my wallet and I get turned into Swiss cheese. It's horrifying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kolbein Mani, this guy's from Iceland. Oh, actually, really quick on this guy. This is a fascinating thing to go back to, like, looking back at your ancestors and the names. In Iceland, apparently, this guy was telling me, he sent me on Twitter, he has a record of every one of his ancestors up until, like, 1925
Wow.
AD. And they just have all the names. And by the way, they also have the years they lived from. Anyways, so this guy asks, what is it like to hang with Joe Rogan?
It's just incredibly awesome. I'd love to get back on his podcast. The first time I went, I'd had way too much water beforehand. I think I peed like 3 or 4 times during that podcast. I also wish that we'd had like a whole panel of YouTube educational producers there, because as you can tell, I don't know anything. The more I learn, the more I realize how little I know. And Joe and I can just go on and on asking questions and asking why and wondering about things, but we don't always know how to, what answers are out there. And I kept thinking, oh man, I wish, you know, Minute Physics and all the professors from Periodic Videos and 60 Symbols were all here and we could just really ask. Because Joe and I are these really curious people, and we'll ask questions, and we'll also, you know, I can speak only for myself here, but I'll misunderstand something, and it's not until I keep asking really smart people that I finally get the answer. But then by looking at what I got wrong, what I misunderstood, I can better explain to people that the concept is now new to. And that's very much what writing a script is about. It's me going, what? How is that possible? And then I read something and I go, oh, but if in that case, then this should happen, but why not? And oh, it's because I'm misunderstanding it. And eventually I get there and that turns into the script of me going, well, but if this is the case, then why not that? And it's basically my story of how I came to learn or wrap my head around something.
I don't think it's bad to ask questions at all. It just shows that, you know, you're as inquisitive as anybody else, and you want to know as much as anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And a certain humility to that is really important. Like to think that, you know, to embrace the fact that you don't know everything, and that but that you're still curious is really important.
Absolutely. Johnny Audifo asks, what would you say is the most enjoyable part about making your videos?
The most enjoyable part. That's tough because I enjoy all the parts, really. And like even the parts that are not fun in the moment. I once heard an astronaut tell me that they have this saying at NASA or in the Air Force or something that there's two types of fun, type A and type B. Type A is stuff that it's like just really fun to do, like eating ice cream. Type B fun is stuff that's only fun once you're done doing it. like exercising, you know, or I don't know, maybe it's not a good example, but something that you're glad you did after the fact, but while you're doing it, you're like, why am I doing this?
Right. I would say that is the existence of making content, period, whether it's
exactly.
Animation or making a video. But doing the research, I'm sure, is not fun immediately. You're reading stuff and you have to absorb it and really sit on it. And it's a cocktail you have to deal with, I'm sure.
Well, I would say the research is really fun. And the danger that I have is that I get too into the research part of it because I keep wanting to learn. And it's so rewarding to ask questions and learn and read books and read papers and talk to people. But the hard part is the synthesizing of that information into a script. And it's easy to go, well, I could sit down and start writing the script, or I could read another book, or I could draw some more diagrams and think about this, or pace around and talk out loud about the topic and imagine. But to the actual process of the work part of it, that is, okay, what's the first sentence? What's the structure? What's the title and thumbnail that allow this to all come together into one thing? That's not always as fun. And you know, setting deadlines or having other people set them for you is really the only way I can, move on from the. But I can learn more. There are other angles I can approach this from. And the episodes, as you can see, just get longer and longer. But, you know, I hope people appreciate the work that goes into it and the necessity of that work.
Do you ever have a sense after you finish a video, like, I could have done that better, I should have, but you just have to put it down and move on eventually?
I do, but not immediately. I wonder why this happens, but sometimes, you know, I'll work really hard on a topic and I'll get pretty close to what I think is a good explanation or a good, new way to visualize something or explain something. And then, months later or a year later, I'll be forced to explain the thing again and I'll do it in a way that I just wish I had done in the actual video. Gyroscopes is one example. I was just thinking, oh, I need to be prepared to explain why a gyroscope stays up. and in case it comes up in this interview I did. And I was like on a plane thinking, and I just came up with a really quick explanation that I was really happy with. And I'm like, man, I wish I'd thought about that during the video. But I think it took time. Like, I had to learn it and then not think about it for a while. And then I'd come back to it and do a good job. Like, in the moment, it can be really difficult to distill a lot of information.
Dougie says, most regrettable video you put out. I don't think he means regrettable as in the literal sense of regrettable. I think he means in terms of what would you have changed or what would you have just not released for whatever reason.
Okay, so not released at all. I think, there are none that I would want to, that I regret making. There might be particular things that I regret, or I could have said better, or not at all. And sometimes it's just kind of boring. Like, I think that in the Bonnet-Tarski video, I could have explained how the points are placed onto a sphere better. And I really wish that I'd said that differently. I think, other than that, like, a lot of the more kind of goofy and silly stuff that I did in the past was also, you know, serve some positive purpose. You know, making people wonder about the universe is important, but just making them laugh is also just as important. And Mario Farts is a classic example of that kind of dumb thing that you might think is dumb, but actually, like I said, I've seen a cat use logic, but I've never seen them laugh. And so when you make someone feel joy and you make them laugh, like, you're doing something very special. So, yeah, that's a long way of me saying I don't regret any videos. I might think I could do a better job today, but I didn't ever think, oh, I gotta delete that.
That's a perfect way to put it. I think I could have said it better myself.
Deather Dan asks, how do you feel about all the memes with your YouTube videos where they change your YouTube titles and views?
I've never heard of would you call it a meme?
Yeah, I think it's this little picture where it's like there's text on the top and bottom sometimes.
How do you spell it?
M-E-M-E?
M-E-M-E?
I think it's called a meme or a meme, I'm not sure.
It could be a meme. Interesting.
You know, let's go with that. Yeah, you know what, skip this for now. I'll send you some memes later if we can find them. I'm curious about this.
Yeah, send me some. I've never, and they're on the net.
Yeah, they're on that deep web.
Oh, that sounds scary.
It's a really scary place. You know, I don't know what I'm thinking about. It's giving me shivers up my spine thinking about these memes on the deep web.
Yeah, let's be careful.
You know what? This is probably all going to be cut out. I don't want to get FBI knocking at my door. Chris Moore asks, in episode 1 of Minefield, you lasted 3 days in the room. Would not having a camera affect your performance? And Zach, how long could you last? Well, I'll let you answer that. Did having the camera on you in that room, do you think that helped? Did you feel a little bit more at ease knowing there was somebody there?
It definitely helped. It didn't feel like anyone was there because there was no reaction at all to anything that I did, so I didn't get any feedback. But having the camera there meant that I was always reminded that there was a point to what I was doing, and so feelings of wasted time never happened. I knew that, like, every moment was being captured and the experience was being recorded and was sort of worth it in that respect. So it was completely different from someone who's actually locked up in solitary confinement. It couldn't be further from that experience. Same with solitary confinement being used as torture, or when someone's imprisoned against their will, or even society's will. It's just so different. The cameras allowed me to, you know that what I was doing had a goal.
I think you even said it in the episode, which, by the way, it's a great series. I don't think I've finished all of it, but I think I got up to episode 5 or 6 just because I didn't have the time. But it's a great series. But I think in that episode, you said, you or somebody else said, if you locked like a different animal, like a mouse or a cockroach, into solitary confinement, they wouldn't be affected by that. But because we're social animals, that's like torture. That's the worst torture you could get, basically, in a social setting, because we're social creatures. That, I never even, like, clicked it that way, why solitary confinement was so bad.
Yeah, we develop in a social world, and when you cut that stuff away, you're not in an environment that you evolved to thrive in. In a short duration, just 72 hours, which is, you know, short, I put that in quotes. In that period of time, I think the lack of social interaction has less of an impact as the lack of circadian rhythm cues, not knowing what time it is, not knowing if it's day or night or when to sleep or when to eat. That was immediately jarring. And so in a lot of ways, I gave myself this extreme jet lag, and I hadn't been aware of how connected to the earth I had to be to function normally. That was the biggest surprise.
How long after you left that room were you kind of out of it for? Did it take you a little bit to kind of get back in step with stuff in terms of like your sleep pattern and kind of just absorbing people's reactions and stuff again?
No, it was actually really immediate because, that night I stayed up really late talking to my wife about the whole experience. And then I slept a little bit, woke up the next day, and it was just an amazing sense of freedom. And I went to bed that next night and it was very, very normal. But I definitely learned how to meditate to alleviate anxiety, how to be alone with yourself and be okay with that and just allow your mind to wander, to allow yourself to sort of daydream, to experience waking dreams, to kind of pass the time and not become frustrated or anxious.
I do not think it could have lasted as long as you did, even with the camera there. I'm a weak soul. You're a strong man for enduring that for 72 hours.
The only two moments that were scary were the one when I closed the door when I first got in and I realized, holy cow, what have I gotten myself into? I've got a long time to wait. And the other scary moment was when I stopped being able to tell the difference between whether I was awake or whether I was asleep and dreaming. Because all of my dreams took place in that room for some reason.
Oh my God.
In a dream, and they would be very normal things. And then I'd wake up, and I wouldn't know if it had really happened or not. It wasn't even what's real and what's not that was scary, but it was also duration of time and how I did not have any concept of time passing. I couldn't tell you how long ago I had been on the bed or how long I'd been pacing. I couldn't tell you how long into the future it would be before I should eat or before I would get out. And I started to perhaps feel like a bug might feel that, you know, death isn't scary if every moment is exactly the same and there's no progress and there's no past.
Good Lord.
Yep.
And that was only 72 hours. I cannot imagine being locked in solitary confinement for weeks or months.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there a whole different set of variables come into play. Because although you may have in solitary confinement lights that go on and off, you have a sense of days passing, you have meals delivered, so you at least have that kind of pacing, but you also have a door that you cannot open. You're not there voluntarily. And that is completely scary in a way deeper way.
It's especially scary when you realize you hear stories, I mean, not super frequently, but you hear stories of people getting thrown in there by accident, or like innocent people, I mean, tossed in there. On that light note, let's see what else. How long would I last? I don't know. Probably, again, 5 minutes before I broke into full psychosis. irreversible psychosis. What is your favorite part about doing Brain Candy Live? Any standout moments?
My favorite part in general is just that it's a live show, that I get to be on stage again. I did a lot of theater in college and in high school, and I get to be back out performing live, not scripted, just like straight up in front of a bunch of people, entertaining them and like getting feedback from them immediately, not in the form of comments, but in the form of actual noises and eyeballs and interest. And that is a totally different experience. That's really energizing. I can do the same show 40 times and it never feels like the same show because it's new to the audience every night. In terms of particulars, Adam and I do a meet and greet after every Brain Candy show where we actually get to talk with and take photos with like 100, 120 people. And just to hear their stories and what they're fascinated by and what they love and what they want to do in the future is just really, really makes me feel so gosh darn lucky to be doing what I'm doing.
That is really cool. So people like tell you that you inspired them. That they, do you ever get any guys or girls who say they got into college, or they went to, they got a degree in college because of you, or they pursued this career because of you?
Yeah, I hear a lot of that, and I'm just like, oh my gosh,
wow.
how incredible! Like, what I do is celebrate what real scientists do. I'm not a scientist. I'm not even a teacher. I am a entertainer that happens to, you know, reveal what we are, you know, somewhat certain about the universe. And if that can translate into someone wanting to pursue a certain career in science, that's fantastic. But that's not even the only point. I mean, I think just being more comfortable with what you don't know, and with being curious and learning how to learn more and how to research, makes everyone a better person, a better citizen. You don't have to become a scientist in a laboratory to benefit from learning and curiosity.
Do you feel like there's a bit of a public acceptance for science in the last 10 years that's kind of gone up? Or is that just an illusion? I definitely feel like in my personal, very anecdotal experience, the last 8, 9, 10 years, there's been a big surge, or at least a noticeable surge, in people's interest in science again.
I think a lot of it is traced back to the way information has just become easier to access. Like, it's way more democratic now. You're not confined to what you can access physically in your neighborhood or amongst people that you know, but you can actually look things up, and you can ask a question and Google it and at least get some preliminary information or direction. And it means that, you know, I think we're understanding that science and math are not just confined to the walls of a school or a university or a textbook, but we all do it. Information is how we express ourselves. If you've memorized a whole bunch of American football stats, that's learning, that's knowledge, and it's how you, you know, relate to a thing that you love. And whether it's, you know, Euclid or the Kansas City Chiefs, it's like all learning.
Nibs Tits, what a graceful name, says, everyone, what is your most ridiculous fact that you know?
You know, I love historical comparison facts, like the fact that the ancient Egyptians building pyramids were as old to the ancient Romans as the ancient Romans are to us today. And I'm just blown away by history and where things stand in relation to one another. One of my favorite stories is from a woman who was alive for both the completion of the Brooklyn Bridge and the moon landing. And she said that the Brooklyn Bridge was more mind-blowing because at that time, the idea that you could walk between Manhattan and Brooklyn was unthinkable. But when the moon landing occurred, she could believe it. And so she felt like it was more freaky for that bridge to be built than for us to land on the moon. I don't know how to phrase this. I don't know if I'm going to put this into a future episode or into like a book that I'd love to write at some point. But it's different ways to think about time. And I like to think about how, okay, I was born in 1986. I'll probably die in like 2068. Let's say that's my life. So to someone alive in the year 2117, okay, a century from now, I would be like someone to me who was born in 1886 and died in 1968.
Do you ever go back? Do you ever do this? Do you ever spend hours digging through the rabbit hole of like the oldest people who lived and seeing how much they like link up? The oldest one who ever lived was 122. 122. What a life! I mean, she was. How old was she when World War I started?
I know.
30.
There was a woman, Emma Moreno, and she was the last known person alive to have been born in the 1800s. So, there are no longer any people from the 19th century alive today.
What's really cool about that, though, is, so, I mean, you know, you're my grandparents, probably give or take 10, around the same generation, you know, 1910s and 1930s, around there, I'm assuming. When they were younger, the old people back then, the 70, 80-year-olds, if you were fortunate to live that long back then, which there were a lot of people that did, that was like Civil War veterans.
I know.
I mean, you watch videos of like the 1930s of Civil War veterans doing the Rebel Yell on video. And I'm thinking, my grandpa was alive when this was happening. He could have met people who were slaves.
Yeah.
That blows my mind completely.
It's incredible. History is so much more compressed than we think. We think that things are so distant, but you don't have to go back that far to find people arguing over how funds should be allocated to Civil War veterans groups. And you have to go back even less far to see those groups dissolve because they don't have any members any longer. I have a friend whose mother remembers going to a parade and a Civil War veteran was in the parade. And I'm like, wow, that is way more, it has an influence on our lives more than we think.
Had you ever seen that video of the witness to the Lincoln assassination being interviewed in the 50s on TV?
Yes, I've actually talked about that guy in a video. It might be the Narrow Slice one. But yeah, this guy goes on TV. Like, television exists in his time. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm famous for the fact that I was in attendance at Ford's Theater the day Lincoln got shot. He was like 9 years old. And it's just like, what? It's easy to think of the past as like a story, like some kind of fairy tale. But it happened. And the people that were the characters in those stories are just like you today.
Another great little anecdote in relation to that is I was curious one day. I thought, what is the oldest person, or what's the earliest born person caught on camera? That's a very poorly worded question. But you could have been like, what is the earliest somebody was born that was caught on camera for the first time?
Not just the first photograph of a person, but the oldest. Yeah, right. The person who was born the longest ago that we have a photo of.
Have you done research?
Yes,
this?
I have. And I forget which video it was, but I showed the first selfie, and I showed what's believed to be the first image of a person. But then I think there's a photograph of a very old woman, and she's believed to be the oldest, the earliest born human that there's photographic evidence of. And I don't remember when she was born. Oh, I don't even know what video this was in, but that is such a cool question.
I sometimes go on binges where I'll just watch old videos. I think I did research one time, and the earliest video I could find, from what I found, was one of the popes. I think he was born in 1800. But just look into it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I know. I want to, like, figure it out now.
The woman I think you're talking about, if it's the same person, I think I found a forum, I think, where it was like a woman from the born in the 1790s or 80s, if I recall correctly. I might be dead wrong.
So I just Googled oldest photographed person, and the first result is Conrad Heyer. He was photographed in 1852 when he was 103 years old.
God.
Born 1749. And you look at him and you're like, yeah, you know, besides the fashion, you could just be an old guy today. But you were born in 1749. There was no America. There was no USA.
For another couple decades.
Yeah, yeah.
Zachary T. Noel says, if a cataclysmic event was to wipe out all digital data in the world, but you were given a 5-terabyte hard drive to save whatever information you wanted, what would you save? And that could be videos, articles, scientific data, etc., he says.
All right, so I did a video on this called Messages for the Future, and the question is, if humans are also all going to die, we need to make sure that we include stuff on that drive that will allow potential future intelligent civilizations that stumble upon it to read it, and that's a whole other thing, but I would want to preserve basically the contents of the Golden Record that are aboard Voyager are pretty much in line with, I think, what we would want to do. We want to preserve the variety of experiences on Earth from all types of people, all types of animals. Maybe put my face, like a nice big digital copy of my face as an example of what a human is like. But besides that, you know.
besides your name and saying that you were the creator, you were the god of this planet, besides those two things.
Oh, right, yeah. You know, you could create your own story. You could say, yeah, we're from the planet Michael Stevens, and he was the king of the world. He was really handsome. And also, here's the Library of Congress.
Yeah. But Michael Stevens created that, too, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, Michael Stevens wrote all these books. Enjoy.
He did it for fun.
Wow, yeah. That'd be a lot of power to have.
I would just probably say, yeah, I think the golden records on Voyager 1 and 2 had me beat. Actually, you know what? I would delete all of the audio of all the humans saying hello, and it would just be me talking.
Just you talking. With different accents, pretending that you're different people.
Oui, oui.
I also think that, you know, we shouldn't ignore recent recordings, and we probably wouldn't, but today, to like go outside and just film the streets and stuff around your neighborhood would seem really boring, but watching today, like footage from the 30s or even, you know, HD footage of New York from the 90s, which does exist, is fascinating. And I'm so glad it exists. One of my favorite subreddits is called The Way We Were on Video. I think I got that right. And it's just home movies. It's not recordings of special, extraordinary people. It's just, you know, 1984 Beverly Hills High School graduation. And you're just like looking at these people, and there's some, it's like a wormhole connecting two different points in space-time. And you're getting to, I don't know, I can't put into words what you gain from that. But just those interactions. There's a very famous video on YouTube that's like a night at a 7-Eleven.
I was just going to bring that up. I love that video. I was just going to bring that up.
This is a special 7-Eleven. It comes equipped with dancers for your entertainment.
No cover charge.
Well, she's not really dancing. She's just standing next to the frozen food. Hi, sir. How are you this evening?
Oh, my God. Are you really taking pictures?
Oh, it's not on. Don't worry about it.
I love that because there's nothing about it that's extraordinary, but yet it still is. It's not something that would be in a history book, but yet it's a record of regular human activity. Unlike, we just have nothing like that for, say, ancient peoples or prehistoric people or even people from, you know, historic times, like, say, the 1700s. But we have just an hour of time or whatever it is, 10 minutes of time happening in real time, as it normally did, full of many forgettable moments as well, which we don't usually record, but are just as important.
I think that's why those old videos are amazing. Like that HD video in New York, it's business guys with fucking ridiculous hairdos walking around, but it's a perfect crisp HD. For anybody interested, the 7-Eleven video, if you want to check it out, which I highly recommend. If I recall, it's just like two or three friends walking around the camcorder. It's called 2:30 a.m. at 7-Eleven. Just type in 7-Eleven 1980s, you'll find it. It's like 1987. It's just guys walking around 7-Eleven talking to customers who are walking in. And I think one of the most surreal parts of that video is, like, nobody's on their cell phone, which is obvious. I mean, of course nobody was on their cell phone, but it's weird when you've been buried into this reality for so long, to look back at a time that was not that long ago when people would just, if they were bored or it was late at night, they would just lay in bed or watch TV.
Yeah,
that was it.
And unlike, you know, a reenactment or something made today, it's really from that time. And it's better than what a portrait or some, you know, painting made could tell you. It's almost like you get to be there.
Tristan R. Sickles asks, why? How dare you? Marks off, you failed. What scientific event do you love but haven't made a video about yet? Well, that's to you.
Oh, man. Well, string theory. That becomes a very mathematical concept in a lot of ways, though. I would love to do perspective and how the eye works. I'd love to do death, life and death. What's the difference? What is death? I'd love to do, let's think of something that's more classically like physics. What's an atom? You know, like what are they, what's an electron? It's not some billiard ball orbiting around a nucleus. At least you can think of it that way and it's helpful, but there's no end to things that I want to cover. So that's a tough one.
I think something you're great at is taking a concept like atoms are a great example. Like any kind of like really tiny thing I think about, I always think about the classic like billiard balls orbiting each other. I know it's not that, that's not what it is, but I still can't wrap my head around that. So I think I've always thought you've been great at doing that, kind of like taking a weird, strange concept and kind of cramming it down into a neat package. So I think anything like that would be great to see you cover.
That's what I'm trying to do with dimensions and higher dimensions beyond the three or four that we live in right now. But you know, until I feel like I've done more than what's been done so far, you know, I won't have anything to release.
The dimension one, I'm sure everyone's seen the classic Carl Sagan Cosmos bit, yep, where he takes the, yep, apple and the Flatland. I tried to like visualize it at some point, but the closest I could get to going, okay, I don't get it, but I get how I could, is the same way that an apple with ink on it on a piece of paper is a cross section of a flat plane, is what we are, like a fourth dimensional creature traveling through this universe would appear like a three dimensional creature.
Yeah.
In the same way an apple would look very strange, would grow and shrink and have different shapes.
Yeah.
To two dimensions. That is the furthest I could get to going, okay, I get that, but I still don't get it.
Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out a better way to visualize that. And a lot of it comes down to you really have to intuitively understand what it's like to be a creature in Flatland and how confusing other directions would be. Another really fun link is mirror reflections. When you look in a mirror, you're actually seeing what our universe would look like if it was rotated in four dimensions. It would come back as a mirror image. And if you think of creatures on a flat plane and you could look at it from above or below, you would be looking at them the way they think they are, and also them as a mirror reflection. And they would not understand how you could possibly see them in mirrored. But there might be something there that can help. And a lot comes down to you need to cast yourself out. You need to stop thinking of up, down, front, back, and left, right to truly understand the perspective from higher dimensions. Because to them, it's all arbitrary. To them, your left and right hand can be turned into each other by just looking from the other side.
I never even considered the mirror part. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you can think about taking a little square on a flat plane and rotating it in three dimensions, meaning like, you know, spinning it in a way that it could move itself and laying it back down, and it would go, holy cow, I am a mirror reflection of what I used to be. There's no way I can move in the two directions I know to put my body into this position, and you just did it. And that's what a mirror does to us, because a mirror reflects only front and back, but there's no rotation you can do in three dimensions that allows you to flop two sides and leave the other two where they are. So it's hard for us to comprehend, and we think that a mirror is reversing left and right because we can only imagine a rotation which would flip two sides, front, back, and left and right in that case. So I want to write that up. But the peace of mind for people out there hoping for new videos is that I'm doing nothing but working on them. And I'm even working on projects I can't even tell you about now, but there'll be a lot of content soon. It just takes, you know, it takes a lot of time to create what I want to make and what I hope viewers want.
The last question is from me to you.
Yeah.
And this question is, if you were walking down the street and you heard a rustle from the bushes and you saw a silhouette of a little figure running after you full speed, as fast as it could go, and it's grabbed onto your leg violently, and you're shocked, you're the breath sucks out of your mouth, and you look down, and it's a naked little creature, not like a human, but humanoid, and it has a face resembling yours, but it's biting at you. Would you kick at it? Would you save it? Would you cradle it? Would you preserve it?
I would preserve it if I could. I would try to find some way to restrain it that kept it alive so we could study it. But if I needed to save my own life, I probably would hurt it.
how would you hurt it? If you kicked it, people would be like shriek around you. You're kicking this little, I mean, it's seemingly defenseless against you. If you got on top of it and started punching it in the head, you might like kill it or, you know, break its, you know what I mean? people might react horribly around you, and they might want to help it.
I don't think
it.
They could blame me, though. If it was, does it have sharp teeth, or is it just grabbing me?
You don't know. It's a quick moment of chaos. And it's that's what the sound it's making.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't try to punch it a bunch or hit it with a really heavy object that could kill it. I would try to just push it far enough away that I'd have enough time to, you know, get inside or get inside a car or something that would protect me, but not in the life of the creature.
But what if you push it hard enough and it like hits its head against the pavement? That's it. This lights out.
I wouldn't feel guilty. I would know that I was only acting in self-defense and that it's still preserved well enough that we could study it. But I wouldn't want to like rip it in half or rip its limbs off or cave in its skull in a way that would leave it, you know, make an autopsy less fruitful.
Right, right. Now the question is, so you shove this thing over, as it's falling it says, Daddy. It calls you Daddy. And it hits the ground and it fades into goo.
Ah.
And nobody else saw it. Would you report this event to anybody? Would you assume you've lost your mind? What would you do? Would you be shaken for the rest of the day?
Yeah, I would report the story. I would report it though with an enormous grain of salt, and I would say, look, I'm fully aware that this could have been a hallucination and that I cannot prove it, but I wanted to record that this happened.
You know what? Let's do this. I'm 911, and you're calling me to tell me what you've just seen. All right.
What's your emergency?
Okay, I just wanted to report something that I don't understand what just happened, but some sort of small creature, not like a child, but it was like a human, jumped out and grabbed me, and I pushed it away and it disappeared. Now that sounds crazy, I know. If you ignore this call, that's fine, but this, I'm telling you this
sir,
happened.
Sir, people are in real trouble. What are you holding up the lines with this. What do you mean it disappeared?
Could you send an officer to my location? There might be other evidence that this thing existed. There might be scratches or bruises on me. There might be broken twigs, but it dissolved.
You want me to take valuable officer power. You know, there are crimes out there. You want me to divert attention to you because you saw a little creature that disappeared in the goo? How big was the creature, sir?
The creature was only as high as my knee. And I totally understand how silly this sounds. So take your time. Don't divert an officer from some human's life that's in risk, but I'm going to stay here. I'd like for them to come just to take the report. And if I've gone crazy, then maybe you should send someone, because I should be taken care of. I might be dangerous.
Sir, a bomb just went off in Capitol Hill, and you want us to come send our valuable manpower to help you with this little man?
Just send, you know, a rookie officer when they have time. You know,
how about we send you an officer, a little officer the size of your knee? You know what? Don't call us the brigade. This is a crime, sir. Have a nice day.
All right. Have a good day.
Wow, I can't believe the podcast is already over. It's the same. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you had a good laugh. Hope you learned something. Hope you were interested. Hope you walked away with a big pulsating brain and you learned something. You learned something crazy. Hopefully you learned that I suck. I want to say very quickly before I wrap it up that I am going to resume streaming. I stopped for about a year. I think the last stream I did was like October 2016. It's been a long time. But I'm going to start again, and I'm going to do mostly animation streams and all that stuff. You can see how my process is, how I animate cartoons. Probably a little bit of audio editing, stuff like that. But the big announcement here is I'm going to be doing some, not all, but some Schmucks episodes live. I'll keep you updated on that. Guys, where the hell would my fat thighs and stretch mark tits be without my Patreon? These sons of bitches, they really pull it all together. They help fund my podcast, all the art you see. Paying anybody, any extra stuff that's not me on the channel is funded by these guys directly. So I want to give a special thanks to everybody, whether it's a dollar, a penny, whatever you donate, it helps. Specifically, I would like to thank Dougie, Brandon Roof, Chris Mitchell, Mr. Chris Wood, Clock Watcher, Johnny Anipol, Tyler Schrock, and who the hell could forget Ryan Bennett, Only Wednesday, Jace Baker, Hobo Joe Pizza, Isaac Perry, Colby Monty, Joey Gallagher, Rory Harding, Classius Clay, and Dean Hubbard. Again, special thanks to these guys. They help fund everything that's not done by me. These guys help fund. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon, there are some perks, like you can ask questions to the podcast guests. You get a big fat dump. I'm going to be dumping the raw Flash files, so if you want to dissect and pick apart the cartoons and see how my Jimmy Neutron brain really puts things together, you can do that. So there's some perks if you're interested.
Also, if you haven't already, be sure to smash that subscribe button like you'll be smashing a real girl instead of jacking off to a few pixels on screen.